talk about the relation of the Son to the Father. And in fact, this Logos idea was to remain at the center of these discussions in the early church for several centuries to come. Now, yesterday, we took a look at Logos idea as it appeared in Greek philosophy, most specifically in the school of Stoicism, where Logos becomes that ordering principle, that ordering rational principle of the world, in terms of which the Greek could make some kind of sense out of the orderliness and the rationality that he wanted to see in the visible universe. We noted, too, the distinction that the Stoics made between the Logos as it is in itself, endiathetos, and the Logos as expressed, as being expressed, logos prophorikos. Then we moved over from a Greek, specifically Greek context, to Hellenistic Judaism, and took a brief look at Philo of Alexandria, this great thinker who was trying to express, to explicate the meaning of Hebrew religious ideas in terms of Platonic Greek philosophy. And we noted then how he took this Logos idea from the Stoics and, first of all, placed it within the context of Platonic philosophy, and secondly, as a Jew, as an Orthodox Jew, also used the idea by way of explicating some fundamental motifs of Hebrew theology. Now, we noted too how, in some respects, therefore, the idea of Logos, which he borrowed from the Greeks, underwent some specific modifications. Now, what I want to do today is to take a look at still the idea of the Logos as it is used in the Gospel of John in the prologue, the first 14 verses of the first chapter of the Gospel of John, and then go on to look at the use of the Logos idea in the apologists themselves. Now, just let me read from the Gospel of John again these verses in which this is expressed. It's in the first chapter. You know, the first 18 verses of the fourth gospel, as it's called, are known as the prologue to the gospel, in many respects quite different from the rest of the gospel. Now, if we substitute for the word, the word logos, which it is in the Greek, then we can get some ideas here. In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. And then you move down to the 14th verse. And the Logos became flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth. We have beheld his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father. Now that's an intriguing passage, and has has brought forth all different kinds of understanding, interpretation. Now let me make some comments, which I must say right at the outset, are by no means universally accepted. It seems to me that what one can say here, and I admit to being rather puzzled about this, I'm not the only one, however, who is puzzled. That's the thing that gives me a little comfort here. It seems to me that one can say that the fourth gospel expresses a conception of the Logos, which in appearances is similar to that of Philo. That is to say, in the prologue, the main features of Philo's conception are reproduced in kind of a vivid summary. Take, for example, the notion of the eternal existence of the Word of the Logos. Number two, the relation of the Logos to God and yet its distinction from God. Number three, the creative activity of the Logos. Number four, the function of the Logos in the illumination and deliverance of men. Well, here are four things which one finds in Philo's conception of Logos and in the fourth gospel as well. One other thing. The prologue to the fourth gospel seems to assume that the idea of the Logos is already a familiar one in Christian circles. It's just introduced abruptly, as though it required no defense or no explanation. And the different aspects of Logos doctrine are lightly indicated. They're just touched on, just suggested, not explained at all. Apparently by way of simply of reminding the reader of some things already sufficiently known to him. Now, what this suggests is that some kind of Logos doctrine had naturalized itself already in Christian thought before it was taken up by the writer of the fourth gospel. So before the writer of the fourth gospel, Logos theory must already have undergone some kind of modification. Well, every verse in the prologue, not in the entire prologue, but in these particular verses that have to do with Logos, offer some striking analogies to corresponding sayings of Philo. Now, does this mean that the writer of the fourth gospel was borrowing the Logos conception from Philo? Well, this really is the point at which the argument develops. And I think that it is really too much to claim that the writer of the fourth gospel was acquainted with the works of the Alexandrian thinker and that he consciously derived his conceptions from them. But the possibility that this was the case, it seems to me, must remain whether one now dates the fourth gospel early or, as has been traditionally done, much later. Now, the important question here is, now, if one assumes, and it is simply an assumption, one can't do anything else really than that, no matter which way he decides finally the issue. The interesting question is, to my mind, this. If one assumes that the writer of the fourth gospel was acquainted with the writings of Philo, Then the interesting question is, to what extent does Philo's conception change its character as it is assimilated into the theology of the fourth gospel? Now, there is one huge difference between Philo and the writer of the fourth gospel. One great general difference. It's simply this. John is not concerned merely with the Logos as such. He is concerned with the Logos made flesh. After the first few verses of this prologue, in which he treats of the pre-existent Logos, he passes on to the historical life of Jesus, who is to be identified with the Logos, but not in any simple fashion. In him, that is, in Jesus, he says, the Word, the Logos, had become visible and human and had acted on men with a personal influence. So here then, there is no more mention of the Word or the Logos. And after all, one has to note that any mention of Logos in the fourth gospel ceases with the prologue. You have it only in these first 18 verses and then nowhere else in the gospel. There's no more mention of the Word, which ceases with the prologue to be the subject of the gospel. And it seems to me what he's saying then is that through Jesus, the Logos manifested itself, informing all his actions and sayings with a divine significance, but henceforth it was the Word made flesh, indissolubly bound up with the human personality. The theme of the gospel, therefore, is not the Logos, but the divine human person, Jesus the Christ. Now, if John accepts Philo's conception, I say if he does, in order to assimilate it to his account of an historical person, it is evident that the conception could not be accepted or adopted without submitting to some radical modifications. Now let me, I say in general, the great difference is that the writer is not concerned with the Logos as such, but with the Logos made flesh. Now, beyond that, or in the context of that, what modifications in the whole conception are evident in the fourth gospel? Let me mention briefly three things. In the fourth gospel, the Logos is not an abstract principle, but is a person. That's one difference. The Logos, which was to clothe itself in flesh and to act on men with the force of a personality, must in its ultimate ground be a personal being. Now, we noted yesterday that Philo, maybe through some poetic impulse, or maybe because of the composite origin of his own speculation, Philo at times attributed a kind of semi-independence to his Logos. This may have prepared the way for later personification. But the point is, Philo himself thought only of a divine principle, the creative reason of God. Now, John makes it central in his conception that the Logos, the Word, has a ground very important now, a ground of independent being within God. Here's the really the crucial thing. He solemnly says in the second verse of the prologue, he was in the beginning with God. Not absorbed in him, but standing over against him in some kind of distinction. So his view then, even of the pre-existent Logos, seems to be dominated by his knowledge of its ultimately becoming flesh. Put it this way, the writer of the fourth gospel seems to me is saying here that with that from all eternity, there must have been an essential distinction of being within the divine nature before the Word could at last appear in Jesus Christ. Now, it's that kind of thing, you know, that's to trouble early Christian fathers for many centuries to come. Well, that's one thing. The Logos in the fourth gospel is not an abstract principle, it's a person. Number two, the Logos in the fourth gospel is not a cosmic agent. It's rather a spiritual agent. For Philo, the creative activity of the Logos was important. That's determinative of his whole conception. But in the fourth gospel, this falls into the background. It's only alluded to, it's only mentioned here in this one verse. Verse 3. You know, all things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. Now, it's perfectly possible, as has been suggested by a number of scholars, simply to omit verse 3, and the thing flows smoothly without this. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. And then you could skip verse 3. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Well, it's only in this one verse that we have any clear trace of this aspect of Logos doctrine. And the point is that the sequence of thought would still be complete even if this allusion in verse 3 were omitted. Maybe this is thrown out simply by way of acknowledgement of the recognized theory. Well, one doesn't know. Some reference, I suppose, to the cosmic significance of Logos was necessary if any link with previous Logos speculation was to be preserved. But the real point is that to John himself, the way in which the world came into being is not a question of either primary or secondary interest. He just doesn't care. He is concerned, however, almost totally with the spiritual life as it resides in the Logos and is communicated by him to men. So, the cosmology of Philo falls out of sight. In fact, it even appears to be controverted, to be objected to. That is to say, the writer of the fourth gospel knows nothing about this absolute transcendence of God, which made the theory of an intermediate creative agent necessary. The fourth gospel, to the contrary, assumes that the world is the direct object of God's love and providence. You know, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. He doesn't have to have some intermediary agent here. The fourth gospel maintains that God acts immediately on the human person and so prepares the way for the redeeming work of the Logos. The point then is that the hypothesis on which Philo builds is really set aside, and the Logos, as he conceives it, ceases to have any real place or function. In the fourth gospel, we really have entered into an entirely new world of thought in which Philo's ideas, if that's what is at work here, is brought into entirely new relationships and thus radically transformed. Well, the third thing here, third modification of Logos doctrine in the fourth gospel is that, you could put it this way, the Logos is not creative reason, but rather the revealing Word of God. In the fourth gospel, that is to say, the term Logos discards or retains as little as is absolutely possible of the philosophic meaning. In the fourth gospel, the Word is regarded as the expression of God's will and God's power. The Word is the self-revelation of God's inward nature. So, from the speculations of the Greek thinker, the writer of the fourth gospel reverts, as he indicates in his opening sentence, instead of talking about Greek speculation, he reverts to Genesis. In the beginning was the Word. That's where he finds his analogy. The ultimate ground of all things was the Word of power by which God uttered himself. And so in the following verses, the whole stress is laid on the life that was in the Logos. It's not an abstract reason anymore. It's a divine energy, powerful, life-giving. It's the inward being of God become active and going out from him. So I guess one has to say then that in its fundamental thought, the prologue to the fourth gospel is more directly related to the Old Testament than it is to Philo. It presents, maybe, if there's any connection with Philo, one has to put it this way. It presents under forms borrowed from Alexandrian speculation the Hebrew idea of the Word of God by which God at once reveals himself and gives effect to that purpose. And it's on this conception of Logos that the gospel is based. Christ is sent out from the Father as speech goes out from a man to reveal his mind and his character. And as the divine word, he is also in accordance with the Hebrew idea, the medium of God's quickening power. In him was life. You have life through his name. And so on. Well, what conclusion can one come to? If the writer of the fourth gospel is acquainted with Philo's doctrine, it is not accepted without essential modifications. And I think that his impression of the actual life of Jesus reacts on a philosophical hypothesis and fills it with new content. So that, number one, John's Logos is not an abstract principle, but a person. And number two, it's not a cosmic agent, but a spiritual agent. Number three, it's not creative reason, but the revealing Word of God. And I think with that, one can let it go. Then I think, in the long run, I suppose the question of whether or not John borrows the form of logos speculation from Philo is a matter of relative unimportance. Now, you want to make any comments on this,
no.
Herr Peters?
I'm glad that you connected this Hebrew thought here to the scene of prologue, not just as a Greek form, but that it is definitely the Old Testament heritage and roots and thought pattern. Because I think that this is a very valid approach to the prologue and makes the fourth gospel much more consistent with the whole biblical witness.
Any other questions or comments? Yes.
Well, on this, we had a Jehovah's Witness down at our house, all the things that were
in, I became here. Yesterday I had a comment from a lady who was here who said that when people raise questions, ask them to raise their voices because she didn't hear. Could you do that, please?
Yeah, there was a Jehovah's Witness that down there. He read this particular portion here, and where they had substituted, now this was the Watchtower vision of the Bible, and in the beginning, the Word was a God. And I told him, I said, I was limiting my notes from a God.
Well, what conclusion did he draw from that?
Well, he didn't want to know about that, but I wonder how they had translated it in this manner. I'm not a Greek scholar.
The Word was a God as a translation of the Greek?
That's an article before Logos Mystic.
Right, right.
And it therefore could be seen as a rather than
B. Yeah. All right. So, what conclusion do you draw from it?
Well, he couldn't explain it at all. And I know that I checked the Revised, I checked the King James,
Yeah. Well, you see, usually in the Greek, when you have the word theos, God, usually in the New Testament, it's always preceded by the definite article, ho theos, the God. It's just kind of a general literary device that's always employed, Now, it's kind of strange here. As Peters points out, that in the prologue to the fourth gospel, the definite article, the, is missing. You simply have theos here without the definite article. And so you leave yourself open then to the possibility of translating this, the word was not the God, but a God. Now, that's not a great discovery, but the important thing is, what do you make of it? Well, he didn't explain it to you, huh?
This is the Jehovah's Witness basis for denying the incarnation, the doctrine of incarnation that the Christian Church had proclaimed.
Well, explain now. I don't understand this at all.
Well,
should we take time here getting clear on Jehovah's Witness doctrine? But, can you...
Well, I just remembered talking to some people also from the Watchtower, and this was the point. They feel that we have made too much of this business of God revealing himself in Jesus, that the Word actually would become flesh. And they have... they have really... break it down, as I remember, to three different points. The Word of God actually never died. Jesus died, but the eternal Logos does not die. And this is because he never really became a man. He never became flesh. as the church has taught. And so the whole idea of salvation that we have taught through the flesh of Christ, whose body and blood was given, shed on the cross, this whole concept is just removed. All because of the basic thing that that's an article right there. He is a God, not God.
Yeah. Okay.
Doesn't the word order in the Greek indicate something other than angel? Yeah. It indicates even greater stress than thought would be. I mean, it's a way of showing something more than even thought, like saying God, you know? Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anything else now? Yes.
I'm just breaking down the last one. You said the other day in your lecture that there was a difference in the translation between the logos, which was reason, and what was somehow translated speech. Is this indicated in the biblical language, or is this what you have of the root or historical
language? I think that the distinction between logos, you know, as reason or as word or as speech is really a distinction within Stoic thought. Yes, I think Philo makes use of the distinction, but I'm not sure that distinction here is involved in the fourth gospel. I think, you see, that if you use that distinction and apply it to the fourth gospel, that it would be logos in the sense of word, which then really is in consonance with the whole Hebrew conception of the word or the wisdom of God. So if you use that distinction, it's the latter of the two that is relevant. Does that speak to the question? All right, we have a few minutes left. Let's turn now to the apologists. That's where we got started from here. And now we finally return after this long, circuitous route about logos theory. Now, I think that whatever one thinks about the fourth gospel here and its use of logos idea in the prologue, it is quite clear that when one comes to the apologists, one has here a self-conscious adoption of the Greek and the Philonic or Philo's view. Maybe in our discussion we should have omitted the prologue to the fourth gospel here. Now, let me just say three things briefly about the logos idea in the apologists, and then tomorrow morning we can raise, first of all, the very important question about the relation of logos to the Father. Number one, the first thing that can be said is this. According to the apologists, particularly now Justin, the logos is, well, you could say it in different ways. The logos is the mind of God. Or maybe one could put it better by saying that the logos is the principle by which God manifests himself. Whenever God appears, whenever he's made manifest, or you could say it, whenever God reveals himself, it is the logos which appears. In other words now, the logos then, on the apologist view, is God's manifestation of himself. That's what it is. That's one thing. The second thing that the apologist said was this, that this Logos, this self-manifestation of God, is in Jesus, the man Jesus, who is the Christ. In fact, they affirmed that the Logos is in Jesus, the Christ, in a unique way. And according to the apologists, this is simply the greatness of Christianity. This is the basis of its claim for salvation. Because if the divine Logos in its fullness had not appeared in Jesus as the Christ, then no full salvation would be possible. Now, one here could pause, as some have done. I'm thinking here especially of these lectures of Tillich in the history of Christian thought, who points this up again and again, and maybe it's worth noticing here, that the predominant interest of these theologians in the early church is what Tillich calls practical. That is to say, their argument here is the argument, how does he put it? Their argument was the argument from existence and not for the sake of speculation. Let me try to put it in a different way. And I think this is helpful. One has to remember, it seems to me, in order to keep things straight, that these speculative ideas which the early fathers employed for the sake of explicating to a Gentile world the meaning of fundamental Christian affirmations, these speculative ideas were not produced for the sake of speculation. Rather, they were produced, they were used for the sake of making Christian salvation understandable. So, and I think this is true, that when one takes a look at the use of speculative Greek ideas and ideas borrowed from other sources in early Christian theology, in the early fathers, in all these decisive moments of the struggle between different movements here, we find that the classical theologians who finally win the victory always argue this way. They say, if there is to be salvation, then such and such must be the case. Here, if there is to be salvation, then this must be the concept of the Logos. That's their way of arguing. There is salvation, they say. It has been promised. We have experienced it. But precisely because we have experienced it, we must speak in this way or that way about, let's say, Logos. My point is, then, that the apologists used the concept of Logos taken from a long philosophical development which began way back with Heraclitus in the 7th or 6th century B.C., which went through the Stoics and Philo of Alexandria. They used this idea in order to interpret the meaning of Jesus as the Christ to their contemporaries. But their chief interest in doing so was religious rather than speculative. All right, two things they said. Number one, the Logos is, and it's nothing more than this, the Logos is God's self-manifestation. And number two, this Logos appeared in a unique way in an historical person, Jesus of Nazareth, who is the Christ. Now, there's a third thing that they say, and it's a very important idea here. The Logos, they said, is the universal principle of divine self-manifestation. Now that's a terribly important conception. Wherever, now here's the point, wherever God manifests himself, there is the Logos. Anywhere, anytime, any place, from beginning to end. The Logos is the universal self-manifestation of God. Now, you see, when they say, therefore, that this Logos is in Jesus the Christ, they are claiming that this universal self-manifestation of the divine appeared in the historical reality of Jesus. Thus, and this is the conclusion they drew, one could say that he, Jesus, or the Christ, is universal. And in terms of what the apologists thought, then, nothing in principle could be excluded in Christian thought, even if it didn't actually develop within Christianity. This is at least part of what they meant by the universal. And of course, this explains why they could talk, for example, about Socrates being a Christian before Christ. Why? Because the Logos, who is the Christ, operated with Socrates or with the prophets of the Old Testament. Wherever God manifests himself in the world, there is Logos. And this Logos now became incarnate, became man in one person, Jesus Christ. Now, I don't know how this grabs you, and maybe I'm reading something into it. But let me just close today with this. If what we've been saying here is true about this, then it really seems to me that what these apologists are doing is to make one of the most tremendous assertions that could ever be made, simply by the use of this word, love. But what do they say? Now, maybe I'm reading into it, but it seems to me that they are saying now that everything that Logos stood for with the Greeks, you know, the principle of rationality which pervades the whole world, or whatever Logos stood for in Hebrew speculation, the word, the expression of God. Now, all this has come to be manifest in one man, Jesus, who was crucified as a criminal. Now, I know, I just get goosebumps all over me when I think of the tremendous affirmation that is involved in this. Not only, of course, the Jesus who was crucified, but at the end of the day, who was also raised from the dead. Well, now, what I want to say tomorrow, what I want to say for first of all tomorrow is that by putting the matter in this way, that is, by identifying the Logos with the Christ, these apostles also raised a very, very great problem. And it was a problem that was exercised in the mind of the church for a number of centuries to come. What was the problem? If you say that Christ is the Logos,
self-manifesting God. Now, what is the relationship between Father and Son in terms of law of standards? And what question is that? That is really the Trinitarian question. Now, it's interesting, you know, that it's raised in precisely this one as early as 150. But now we have to move in on some of the really fundamental theological questions that were the exercise of the church for many centuries before. And the settlement of the disputes that were to be aroused about this, the settlement of that of those disputes is reflected in what we now confess as the Nicene Creed. Now I hope next week we'll be able to give you some of this and then take a look at the Nicene Creed.